Welcome to the Victorious Souls Podcast with self-love coach Danielle Burnock. Things happen in our lives that make us feel powerless. But Danielle believes that anyone can become a victorious soul by reclaiming what belongs to them, their value, their belovedness, and their God-given superpower. The Victorious Souls Podcast is dedicated to empowering you to rise up, reclaim, and embrace the change from survive to thrive as a victorious soul through the power of love. And now, here's that lady on the internet who loves you, Danielle.
Welcome to Victorious Souls Podcast with me, your host, Danielle Burnock, that lady on the internet who loves you, connecting you to the love that heals so you can love yourself from survive to thrive. And today I have with me Crystal Fedeli. She is an international alcohol recovery coach, but not just that. She also has an MA in child advocacy and policy, also in research and analysis, but she's been in the trauma recovery field for 10 years. And I really want to hear how all these three go together. So thank you for being with me today. Crystal, I'm just stumbling over myself because those three things that I just, child advocacy, research and analysis, somehow those don't seem to go, but then you're in the trauma recovery, but alcohol recovery. So how did you get into all of that variety of things that they must go into one because you're one person? So how does that all fit together? How did you get into that field?
Yeah. So thank you for having me first. And then, so yeah, to answer your question, how does it all go together? So my education obviously is 2 graduate degrees. And of course, to get to my graduate degrees, I had undergrad degrees, but we'll just focus on the graduate. But it's, research and analysis. And then the other one is child advocacy and policy. And so that's my education. And then my professional experience is the, 10 plus years in the trauma and addiction recovery field. So an alcohol recovery coach is now where I am in my career, having branched off and doing my own thing, right? So, yeah, so basically, my graduate degrees are very specific and strategic. So, I'm really about just, first of all, introducing actual solutions, right? But here's the thing. Actually, I've never actually approached this conversation like this on a podcast, but I think it's really amazing. Okay. So our current recovery field, and I always focus on alcohol because that's just my expertise. I'm sure it can be applicable to the wide range of substances, but I'm always bringing it back into the context of alcohol recovery. But it's actually the literature, the peer reviewed scientific literature indicates to us that our current recovery system is based on what we would call a practice based approach. And so that is based on tradition, right? What we've always done, and providers' opinions, what they think is right, right? Which I can't think of two things to base such an important issue and subject matter and tangible experience that people, real people actually have, then based on what we've always done and what our opinions are, right? Now, this is as juxtaposed to an evidence-based approach, which is based on research, which is basically a fancy way to say what works for the most amount of people, the most amount of time, in the best way possible. Of course, you're always going to get outliers, right? For which maybe the practice-based approach would work well for, right? But the evidence indicates that our current system's approach, it helps the outliers. And so we're not helping the majority of people. And so, policy, whether it's child advocacy and policy or any kind of policy for the population at large, in my view, and I think what is right, it should be based on the evidence. It shouldn't be based on tradition and opinion. So, yeah, so that's sort of why I earned my 2 degrees where I did. because I really wanted to focus my approach and my advocacy on the research and the evidence. And that's what I studied my entire time earning my two grad degrees were, you know, alcohol recovery and for something that my nonprofit is built on, which is completely different than what we're talking about now that helps single moms who can't afford basic necessities. So, but that's completely separate. But those two subjects are where I focused all my research on. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, what led you into that? Why did you want to go into child advocacy? Why did you want to go into alcohol recovery? Why did you want to do trauma recovery? What led you into that field in the first place?
Yes, well, my own experiences. So I was a former recipient of Child Protective Services as a child. I had a very traumatic childhood, very chronically traumatic, you know, and I got into what I wanted to get into because I always wanted to help. I always wanted to help. I think when you go through something, you just have a natural byproduct mindset that you want to help. For most people, in some way, in some capacity. And that's what I was passionate about. So I started, you know, acquiring employments that allowed me to do that. But then I guess with how God created my mind is that I always find the problems. I always find the issues and it really irritated me. And I'm also a person who's like very justice minded and oriented. And so I had a hard time functioning inside the system myself, because I'm like, I can't do this if it's wrong, if it's going to cause more harm than good.
Your experience in the Child Protective Services? How did you experience it? What happened in your childhood with that? Were you like taken out of the home? Were you in foster care? What happened?
Yeah. So my personal experience, not in my career, you're asking. Okay. Yeah. So basically, let's see. Well, my childhood story. Okay. So basically I was a mistake in the natural. My parents had me by mistake. They didn't mean to. And then back in the 90s, what happened is that like you got married if you created a child outside of marriage, at least from where I come from. And so my parents got married, but it was almost like just a tornado meeting a volcano and it erupted. And so when I was 18 months, they were divorced. And my mom just used the court system to keep me from my father. And so basically my mom was really not well. I believe she must have had like borderline personality disorder. And so she was very emotionally abusive, mentally abusive, and physically abusive at times. Very scary childhood. She would go on like rampages and just like smash everything that could be smashed in the house, every breakable thing. I mean, she threw my guitar down the steps one time, broke my toys, you know, would be physically violent with me at times. And like, maybe like now talking about it, it's like, well, that's not bad. Like other children go through much horribler. That's not a word, but
no, trauma is personal.
Yeah. But it was pretty scary. And the mind stuff was just, it just wired my central nervous system to terrible. And, you know, I would see, arguments between my mom and my grandparents. We lived with them until I was 10 years old, and like physical altercations where my grandparents would physically assault my mother. And my mom would just smash everything in the house. And anyway, so it just was a very tumultuous environment. And then when I was 7, both of my parents remarried their separate spouses. So my mom married my stepdad, my dad married my stepmom. And so when I was about like a preteen, I forget the exact year it started, but my mom's spouse started to, do stuff that he shouldn't have been doing, that later landed him going to jail for. I think we can all infer what that is. And So that was happening. And I kept it inside for so long, for years, because I didn't know what would happen to my mom and my siblings. My mom had rheumatoid arthritis, so she was like very crippled. And so I knew she physically couldn't take care of us. She didn't even have a high school education, which is weird to me because her obituary said she did. So I don't know who lied to me. Someone lied to me. But anyways, even if she just had a high school education, she just had a high school education, or she didn't at all. And so all she could really do was waitress, and she really couldn't do that either because she was physically not able to. She could barely walk. And so, yeah, I didn't know what would happen to my siblings. And
how many siblings do you have?
So I have three from my mom and stepfather, and I have three on the other side, but obviously we're just focusing on the mom side. So I just didn't know what happened to them. And also, I honestly didn't know who would protect them from my mother. Like, she was very, like I said, what I went through. So I was trying to protect my siblings. So I just kept it in. And then eventually I blurted it out at youth group camp at, I forget where it was. It wasn't Harvey Cedars. We went somewhere else that year in Tuscarora, PA. I forget where it is. But anyways, and I blurted it out. It came out. And so then obviously the youth leaders had to call my pastor, who had to call the authorities, or I don't know who called the authorities, but you know, and so, yeah. And so my mom was initially just like, I think like, what the heck, you know? And so she initially like listened to me, and I told her what, you know, had happened. And I think she was shocked. But then she eventually adopted the position that I was lying and trying to destroy the family. And it wasn't until I actually was earning my grad degree in child advocacy and policy that I learned the data point for that. And I think I forget what it is, but it's like more than half that is the story for children who are abused by their mom's significant other.
That's why kids don't speak up. They're afraid they're not going to be believed. And
well, that the mom chooses the significant other over the child. It's actually more than half. That's what I meant. That data point. Yeah. And so it was kind of like freeing to me. I find so much comfort in data because I feel like it just validates me. So
yeah, validation is important.
Yeah. It was sad to learn, but it was comforting at the same time, which is like weird, but it was. So anyway, so that's the position that she took, and she eventually just lost custody of me. And so that was my childhood story. And then I went to my father's house, and let me just backtrack really quick, kind of fast forward but also backtracking. So the last time I really saw my mom was October 4th, 2005, 6 p.m. and I was taken from her custody. And yeah, I saw her for like a minute or two at my Oma, my grandma, that's grandma in German. I saw her at her funeral for like literally a minute. I didn't even know if she knew who I was. Apparently she did, but it was playing it off as she didn't. But I just went in there, said goodbye to my Oma, and left. And and then she died last March, my mom. So like, she literally, from the time that she lost custody to her death in March, she just held that grudge until her death, which it's just like crazy because, I mean, you would think like when someone's dying, like that's when they go Rocky Mountain climbing, skydiving, like Tim McGraw says, but, they just do the things that, you know, they were too hard into their whole life, right? They make up with whoever, but my mom just like held that freaking grudge against me, and not logical at all. And she knew she was dying, and she just held it. And that's just how hardened her heart was. And just honestly, what I feel like when you can't logically rationalize with someone, this is just my personal view, that's how you know that it's a spiritual thing. It's in the spiritual realm, and it is demonic. And so unfortunately, you know, that's how it was. But I do believe she's in heaven because she did believe in Jesus. It was interesting to hear her pastor speak of her. It was just interesting, but whatever. So that was my childhood story. And
yeah, that's really interesting. She believed in Jesus, and she was attacking you in all various different ways. You mentioned being at youth group or something like that. So how is God a part of the story during all of this tumultuous time?
Yeah. Well, so obviously I We were Catholic, and then we transitioned to like more of a Protestant evangelical church. It's actually funny because the pastor now is more, like believes in like moving in the spirit and supernatural healings and all that kind of stuff. But back then, I think he was more just evangelical. So it's interesting just and awesome to see how they've, evolved over the years. But yeah, so I went to, a church, and I kind of walked away from it. So when I went to go live with my father, they're like Catholic, but really kind of just like go to holidays kind of Catholic. And I think my stepmom is, she believes, it's just, she doesn't go to church every Sunday or whatever. But it's just so funny because God always had like an evangelical, grace-based Christian. Like I could pick the points in my life and who was in it, like literally always one, sometimes two, but always one person in my life. It's just cool. And so, yeah, so I just kind of walked away from God just because honestly, I thought he wasn't cool. I thought God wasn't cool. Like I thought God was like a geek and I thought being a Christian was a geek.
Whole teenagery of you.
I know. I actually remember having that conversation with God. Like, honestly, God, I remember I was at the youth camp, the same one. It was either the year before that I told about what was happening to me or that year, but I just remember telling God, I remember like the room. I remember it was worship through music. I remember being there and I was just like, God, honestly, I have to walk away because I just want to be popular again. Cause I was not popular when I was like doing the Christian thing. So I'm like, and then I went back to that whole thing, which is a whole other thing in a child's mind. But anyways, so how did God play in this? So basically, fast forward to my early 20s, and I guess here's where it's going to get real. I don't think I've ever shared this publicly before, but I think it's high time I do. My profession was that I was dancing. I was a dancer, and I was selling my body a little bit, and that's what I was doing, and why I was doing it was honestly because I loved the attention. I loved people just paying attention to me, which is also why I had like, intimacy with men, if you can call it intimacy. And that was the only reason. I just wanted someone to love me for a couple minutes because my entire 20s up until I had my first daughter, for which I was a single mom, hence my nonprofit, which is completely separate from this. But, I literally had no one in my life. I had no mom. I had no dad. I had no step parents. I had no aunts, uncles, cousins, siblings, nobody but the men that I slept with. And so like literally like it was awful.
Well, it's normal. Well, yeah. It's your response that you've felt unloved and unwanted. They called you a mistake, which I would like to correct the truth of that. That you were not a mistake. I was also a mistake. I was also an accident, an oops, or like people say, and it harmed me for a long time. But one of the things that I've come to see is God brought you forth. God brought you, gave you life. He gave me life. And so I actually look at that as a strength. Yeah, I wasn't planned, but God planned me. God planned you. And then something else you said in your story, which I think validates this, is he always had someone there. Yeah. He always had someone there. Plus he kept you safe through that time of your life because he knows why we're doing things. You didn't feel loved. And I don't imagine you felt loved by God. It was too much religion and, walls. And it wasn't like a real kind of thing. It's like, God, peace out. I want to be cool. And he does. He gets us. But he doesn't leave us there. He's like, I got you. I'll be back. I'm watching. he was there with you even in the midst of that. And for that, I'd like to stop and pause for my listeners. No matter what you're going through, no matter how much you're pushing God away, if you really inside there, you want him, he's chasing you down and he will apprehend you and love you back into wholeness. And just dare to reach out to him because there's not a thing as too far or too bad or too far gone or anything like that. God loves you where you're at, no matter what you're doing. And he understands. Just reach out. So So he carried you through that, Crystal. And thank you for your courage of sharing that. That must have been really difficult to bring that up. I didn't ever share that anywhere ever before. That takes some guts. So yeah. Congratulations on that as well. We need the validation and the courage to, every time we share, we help someone else. And it strengthens you as well, because now that's not a secret anymore.
Yeah.
Now it's not a secret. Now you feel like you come clean there. It's like, oh, I don't have to hide that anymore. I said that out loud. Someone else heard me, kind of thing. And even with what your stepdad did to you, you know, that's wrong. You know, and your mom blaming you for it. That's wrong. I want to just say these things out loud to validate the truth that childhood trauma is never the fault of the one traumatized. Never, never, never. It was not, you are not to blame for any of that.
Yeah.
So thank you for your courage in that. So how did you end up coming out of that when you're like just trying to find this love in any way you can? How did God reach you and pull you out? Because, you know, your life's completely different now.
I just want to, like, in my mom and father's defense, they never told me I was a mistake, but my oma told me that I was. So I just want to say that just in case, because my father is still alive. So I don't want him to, you know. But anyways, so how I came out of that was I actually just, like, there was like this heaviness. It was in my early 20s. There was just this heaviness around, like, I just didn't want to go back to my job of dancing, you know. And so I just had this heaviness, and I was living with a group of Christian girls, young women, in my early 20s for like college, but I couldn't even go because I couldn't get the financial aid because I didn't have any parents to, you know, do the financial aid app with me, and they wouldn't give me an independency override for, and that's a whole other story. But so for a year I was living with them, they went and I didn't get to go. So I felt excluded once again. I got to go the next year, but anyways, and so I just, like, there was just so much heaviness around just the thought of going back to my job. I just couldn't do it anymore, like emotionally, physically, mentally, like just couldn't do it. And so I just was like, I have bills to pay. So like, you know what, God, if you're real, like, you're going to have to help me with my bills. And it just worked out. Like, people just gave me money and I quit my job. I went back to waitressing. And yeah, so I was able to leave. And then I almost went back like 2 years or something like that, a year or two, three, something like that later. But honestly, I got too drunk that I messed up that interview and I wasn't able to dance at that place. So yeah. So anyways, I guess my alcohol stuff saved me that time, my alcohol issues, but.
So the whole alcohol part of this story, which is what you help people overcome, when did that become a part of your life? And was it little by little, or did it all of a sudden present and become a big problem all of a sudden?
Yeah. So basically, I just started drinking just because that was the norm, socially normal thing to do. College parties, drinking games, very fun. And it just eventually, like a year or two or three, and especially with the job, the profession that I was just talking about, I mean, you really honestly need to do something to desensitize yourself to be able to, you know, do what you do at that job. So I just drank a lot, and and then so it just developed into, I guess, alcohol use disorder. And yeah. And so then it just started to wreak havoc in my life in so many ways. Even when I left, you know, the dancing job, it just really wreaked havoc. Like, I lost another employment that I had, which it was some kind of assistant job. So it wasn't dancing. I was kicked out of prestigious university. I mean, there's just so many things that alcohol wreaked havoc in my life with. And so, yeah, that's how that evolved. And, I tried to go and get help from doctors, from my pastor, from, you know, going up to the front of church after church service for prayer, journaling, praying, begging God for the answer, having an accountability partner, going to support groups such as AA or Celebrate Recovery and therapy. And I just could not get better. And for nearly a decade, and until I found a YouTube video, it was a TED talk, and the speaker was just claiming to have found the cure to alcoholism. And I thought it was too good to be true at first. So I completely discounted it. But eventually I just was like, you know what? If I don't try this, it's not going to work for me. But if I do try it, it might work for me. And so you would think that that would be my happily ever after, but it wasn't. I went to go get what I needed to do this. And I went to my family doctor and they just basically told me that they didn't think I needed the medication that I was looking for. You know, they tried to counsel me on keeping a drink log and, hey, after you have a drink or two, like, that's enough. You don't need any more. As though I just hadn't told her the sheer willpower approach was not working for me for nearly a decade. And then I insisted on speaking to someone higher up. And so the clinical director of the practice came in and told me that she told me she thought I was trying to go through the back door for treatment. And I left without what I needed.
Why did they call it a back door?
Because the addiction field, the addiction recovery field is just so backwards. Again, it's based on tradition. It's based on opinions, right? It's based on a 1930s model where two gentlemen tried to do something good for their community, hence Alcoholics Anonymous. And so they organized this, and that has been what we have followed. We are stuck in the 1930s, and I am so glad for whom the whole 12-step sheer willpower AA model works for. I am so grateful for it. And I also know that our system has a 99% failure rate coupled with that approach. And that doesn't mean like specifically AA. I was on a podcast, actually he decided not to publish it last week, because he didn't like my whole message, which is kind of frustrating. But anyways, so I'm not saying AA specifically. I don't have those data points in front of me. But what I'm saying is the system at large has a 99% failure rate. And we have a practice-based approach, which is based on tradition and opinion. And it is typically an abstinence-based approach. Now, that is what AA is. Yes, you have a whole 12 steps and that's awesome. Self-development, 12 steps, however you want to quantify that. But that is basically the model.
So how is what you did different? You mentioned medication. Can you elaborate on what was it that you actually did? Can you tell us the medication, or is that a secret or something?
I don't know.
It's like, what is it that you did do that actually worked?
So there's a couple things I did. So there's two paths to recovery. There's abstinence or sobriety, whatever you want to call it. And then there's moderation. Now, there's also different approaches to each, either sobriety or abstinence. And what I'm talking about is through nothing but sheer willpower, either abstinence or moderation, that is what has a 99% failure rate, because that is what our system typically uses that leads to those statistics, right? Mm-hmm. And I understand, yeah, there might be like, you know, 12-step model or like SMART recovery. Like I've never been in SMART recovery, but I know it's more like kind of holistic. It's more like caring. I know the AA model, like typically it's like more rigid, like you have to do this and, you know, whatever.
I feel you. I feel that you have had to defend what you have done. I feel that from you.
Yeah.
I would like to just pause here and say, I'm sorry for how you have been treated by people.
Thank you.
In that way. And you don't need to defend it to me. You don't need to defend 12-step. You don't need to defend celebrate recovery. And I agree that different things work for different people. So please share what worked for you.
Yeah. No, thank you.
And share it boldly, because it worked for you. So let it be the awesome thing that it is.
No, thank you for saying that. Yeah, because I guess I don't want to shame anybody for who AA works for them and they like it.
I don't feel that coming from you at all.
Okay.
I feel you're being very careful to not bring shame to anyone.
Yeah, I don't want to. But thank you.
Whatever works, however, get there. It's like, get whole. How are we going to get there?
Yeah, that's actually
my whole
thing.
Turn right, that don't work for you, we'll turn left. Well, maybe you need to go over the hill, under the hill, through the tunnel, whatever. So how did you get there?
Yeah. Thank you. That's actually my whole thing. Whatever works for you, and let's just find it. And that's basically why I do what I do. So basically, you know, so if you're getting away from through sheer willpower, I mean, there's a couple different of, you know, things. And it's not a list that's, you know, just here are the things. It's ever expanding, right? And it can expand for anybody. So yes, there is medication assisted treatment, and there is a couple different medications under that. There are a total of 6 medications used to treat alcohol use disorder, whether you're low, medium, or high in the spectrum, or like me, super high, breaking that thermometer or whatever. You know, so there's a total of 6, and 3 are FDA approved. So here in the States, the Food and Drug Administration, 3 of them are approved. And actually, if you go to my website, the whole gift, you know, that I have for your audience, it goes over specifically those 3 medications and what each, you know, does. But then obviously there are, you can incorporate therapy if you want to. I don't believe that it's necessary. Actually, I think therapy can be more harm than good sometimes. But there's different like therapies, just like you go to a doctor for a very specific reason. Like you wouldn't go to an orthopedic for a heart condition.
Right.
I mean, I'm
right.
sure you could, they could help you a little bit, but they don't really specialize in that. So they can't really truly fully help you. It's the same with therapy. Get therapist practice in a general sense. And this was validated by one of my graduate teachers. She's like, you're right, Crystal. Therapists do practice in a general sense. Well, if you go to a therapist and you have had child sexual trauma like me, and they have you do straight talk therapy, this is what happened, and this is how I felt, and you know, this was... That is so detrimental to somebody. It actually does more harm than good. But if you go to someone who specializes in EMDR therapy, oh my God, that is amazing therapy. And that actually helps that person. Mm-hmm. But if you, you know, tried that for, you know, somebody else, maybe it's not the best for them. So there's different therapies that work are very specialized.
Sometimes they want you to write everything all out. One therapist I went to, it was like 13 pages. I was supposed to fill out all this information. It was traumatizing to do the paperwork.
Oh my God. I don't even fill out paperwork. Like when I have
I didn't
to sign
after
my...
that. That was the only time I'm like, no, not going to what you want. You know, where I went to, she said, I need your driver's license and insurance card. I said, I can do that.
Not writing out all the paperwork. Sorry. Like when I signed my kids up for school and I got to write their name and address like 5 times. I'm like, are you kidding me? But anyways, And then there's support groups, you know, there's very different support groups. They're AA, which some of my clients, I'm like, hey, like if that's what you want and that works for you, let's do that. But let's get you in a place where like AA is actually like something that brings you true freedom, not like you're white knuckling it, you know, trying to stay sober and not drink. Because when you do it that way, you have obsessive thoughts and cravings. And I'd have to go into the whole neuroscience and the brain chemistry, you know, and how different medications, like what they can do to, like make sure that doesn't happen. But there's like, again, a total of 6, so we don't have time for all that. But you know, and so there's a way that you can do it where it's like you're not white knuckling it, like you truly...
What does the medication like do? Does it like relax you? Does it remove cravings? What is it like? What do they like do?
Well, it depends on the medication, but
am I asking too detailed of an answer here?
Well, no, I mean, if we had like a more time, but no, it depends on the medication. And then it also depends on how you use the medication. So like the one medication that I hate, it's called Antabuse. I am so against this one medication because it's the one... Antabuse.
It sounds like abuse, just in the name.
I never even thought about that. I never thought
Antabuse,
of that.
Antabuse. It sounds terrible. The name of
it is. Well, basically, that's
you're
what
gonna
I'm
go kill sure. Ants. Antabuse.
Yeah. Well, that's the. I'm not sure if you've heard of it, but it's the one where you take it and it makes you violently ill. Like if you take the medication and you have any kind of alcohol, you get violently ill. That's the one. Yeah. That's one that, the system is so happy to prescribe that one. That's like literally the only one in most cases that they will prescribe you, which I think is so abusive for somebody. It's like when we give a cancer patient something that harmed them in that way, or somebody who has a hearing loss or something like that. But then it's like, but then people are like, well, you're the person's choosing to drink. No, actually, if you knew the neuroscience behind it, they're actually not, because your brain is actually very powerful and very strong. And actually, doesn't the Bible tell us that things that are unseen are actually more powerful than things that are seen? That's my theory on the brain. So it's like, no, actually, yeah, I see that they're literally physically picking it up and going to drink it. But the neuroscience behind it, it's like, it's just ignorance. So anyways, So that's Antabuse. you know, and then there are a list of medications, yes, that can take away the cravings and, you know, that can really help with that sort of thing. And there's a whole, you know, list in them out of those six, including naltrexone, which, but naltrexone, is the one of the ones that is my favorite because it's one of the ones that I used on my journey, but it can be used in two ways. It can be used either, in an injection form, which is called, this name always leaves me. Vivitrol. So that's the injection form. It gets injected in you, or you can take naltrexone, which is the pill form, 50 milligrams, and you can take it every single day and it will take your cravings away. However, if you use naltrexone through this something called the Sinclair method, and so this is where you take 50 milligrams of naltrexone 1 hour before you consume alcohol because it needs time to like work in your body and to get on those receptor sites. And so if you take this, it is literally the cure to alcoholism. It is the cure. It is the only cure to alcoholism. And the professionals will tell you, the experts will tell you, like the doctors, right? They will tell you that like after you've done this method and you've gotten better, you don't have to take the medication every time you drink. Like if you have a drink like once every couple months or something like that. For me, I found that I went back into full-fledged addiction when I did that. And so for me, I take the medication every single time I want to drink now, because otherwise I know I will go back into full-fledged addiction.
What does it do? You want to stop after one or two, or what? I mean, it takes away the craving, but then if you're having a drink, then what does it do?
Okay. So
this is so fascinating. I've never heard anything like this before.
Yeah. So when you take it every day, it takes away your craving, and it won't work if you want to drink. Like if you want to enjoy alcohol in your life, it won't work if you take it every day to help you to do that. It won't. But if you do it the Sinclair method way, Dr. David Sinclair dedicated his life to, alcoholism research. And actually he, patent or, you know, whatever the Sinclair method, because he wanted everybody to have it, right? And that's where you take it 50 milligrams 1 hour before you drink. And yes, it actually prevents you from over drinking. So basically it just makes me, like, I always compare myself to my husband. Like, he doesn't have alcohol use disorder, so he can drink and have a drink and be done, and he'll never think of it again. Me, if I drink it, because I have alcohol use disorder, because my brain pushes way more endorphins than his does when alcohol is introduced into my system, I will go into full-fledged addiction. I will get the obsessive thoughts. I will get the cravings. I will want to drink. I will constantly think about it, you know, have a thought at 10 a.m., then have another thought at 12 p.m., then another thought at 12:30 p.m., then 12:45 p.m., until eventually I give into it. And then I give into it, and then I drink, like, so much alcohol, like 10 drinks, 15 drinks, 20 drinks, sometimes 25 drinks, if I don't take naltrexone 50 milligrams before I consume alcohol. However, if I do the Sinclair method, then I will enjoy a drink or two, or maybe I won't even finish my drink because I'm not getting all the endorphins. Well, I am getting the endorphins pushed in my brains, but what the naltrexone does, it's an opiate blocker. So it sits on your receptor sites. So the endorphins are being pushed, but you're not receiving the messages. Your brain, it's not receiving the message. It's like that closes the door on that. And so it's just like I'm a normal person. Again, it's the cure to alcoholism. So alcohol use disorder, it is a neurochemical disorder. And it, now we know it's totally treatable, but here's the problem. Finding a provider who will prescribe you this medication, finding a therapist who will support you on this method. Because let me tell you something. When I found this method, I had a therapist of 5 years, and she was happy to see me again and again fail nearly a decade through the abstinence, through sheer willpower, AA, celebrate recovery, whatever, right? Through sheer willpower approach. Once I found this method and I got better, she dropped me as a client because she didn't agree with my method. She said, I just don't think that we're aligned because I just don't believe in doing it that way. Why? Because we just think that once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic, and you have to do it one way, even if it doesn't work. But if you find another way, like, oh my gosh, they can drink again. They can, you know, drink alcohol and not over drink. Well, I just don't believe in that. It doesn't make any sense. It really doesn't. Again, spiritual, demonic. So she dropped me as a client. So to find a therapist who will even support you in this, and to find a support group who will support you in this, that is actually the battle and the hill to climb. Hence why I do what I do. Like, wow. Women come to me and they're like, You know, same story over and over. And it's not like I'm like, oh, here, same story over and over. No, it's really sad every time. And it breaks my heart. And I listen to them and we work through that pain, right? But then it's like, okay, so what are your goals with alcohol? If anything were possible, right? And then I share with them, I think that this way, I think this is the best method for you. And this is, you know, kind of what you need. Do you need medication assisted treatment? Do you need therapy? Do you need a support group? Do you need to do this kind of sort of self-development thing, right? Like, right. We come up with it together, and then I connect them with the people that are going to help them, the professionals that are going to help them. Because that is half the battle. And just to have someone on your side in your corner, like not gaslighting you and like faulting you and shaming you because you can't stop drinking through sheer willpower, and connecting you with people who are truly going to help you, like that's literally the whole freaking battle. Information does not lead to transformation. Somebody in your corner who knows how to get you the solutions, that is what leads to the transformation. And that is why I do what I do. And I'm the only person who I know who does what I do. And
yeah,
then
I have never heard of any of this ever before.
Yeah. And then the fifth and final step of what I take my ladies through is forgiving all those who have caused them harm along the way. Because honestly, for me, it made me so bitter and so calloused, right? And doesn't the Bible talk about becoming bitter and calloused and how harmful it is? Mm-hmm. Because truly, like, you've been gaslit, you've been abused like this whole time, but yet you're left with the residue of all that. And actually, it's very, very mirroring to my childhood. Now, I don't think alcohol use disorder had anything to do with my trauma. Even if I had an amazing childhood, I still would have suffered from this. It's just what was, you know, deep within me wouldn't have like come out when I was drunk, right? As opposed to someone who hasn't been abused. They might just like, you know, just get too drunk or something. For me, all the
alcohol abuse disorder? Never heard it called that before either.
Yeah, lots of scientific.
What causes it? You said it's a neurochemical disorder. What causes it?
It's so simple. Basically, like, let's compare me and my husband side by side. We're both at a bar. We're enjoying a nice cold one, watching the game, right? Like my Jets, who I think lost last night. I fell asleep, but my brain is just going to push way more endorphins than his brain is. And that's the key.
What's the cause? Is someone born with this?
I have a neurochemical disorder. I was just born with it. My brain just, I mean, some people are born without an arm, or some people are born with a hearing loss. Some people are born, people are born with things, right? That they need some sort of assistance in some sort of capacity, right? Like my friend, she was born with a hearing loss. So she wears a hearing aid, or now she has the cochlear, I can never say that word,
cochlear implants.
And awesome, she has a medical device and it helps her, right? And that's fine. We're happy for her. The only thing is that with alcohol use disorder, people don't understand it. And even like my friends, like they know all this. I've had this conversation multiple times. As you can tell, I'm very passionate about it. I talk very fast. I talk a lot of information, and they still will tell you that my alcohol use disorder was caused because of my trauma. They still insist upon it. So people, it's like, there's like this cognitive dissonance. It's the only way I can explain it. We're just so committed to seeing this as a, you know, people drink because they're trying to cope with stress, or they're trying to cope with.
Well, it's possible, maybe a different way. I don't know what your friends think. So I'm not trying to say they're thinking this. It's not what I'm saying. What I'm thinking, because I come from a trauma recovery with what I do, and I do believe that trauma causes a lot of things, but I don't think it's like you drank because you were in emotional pain per se. I think that trauma affects our brain.
Yeah.
It affects our brain. So perhaps chemically it affected your brain, not choice. I believe it. Well, it affects people chemically anyways. Trauma does, because it affects the brain. They can take brain scans and they can see the trauma in the brain. That's where I try and get people to understand that trauma is not your fault. And trauma is not the situation. Trauma is not what happened to you. Trauma is the wound that's left behind after whatever happened to you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that wound can cause various side effects, you know, like if it cut your arm and if it gets infected. I mean, things happen. It's a cause and effect thing.
Yeah. So... All right. So alcohol,
I'm not saying it was. It just, you know, maybe that's what they think. I don't
know. That is what some of them think. And that's actually specifically what one friend of mine thinks. But I just would invite us to really really critically think about it before we, you know, start pouting, touting like our opinions, right? Because that's one train of
thought. That's all it is an opinion. I'm not diagnosing you.
but what I'm saying is that I don't have a problem with that in conversation, just to say, well, it could be this, it could be that, but to be so committed to know that is what it is. Mm-hmm. I think that's where an issue is, because it's like, I'm sorry. Are you a scientist who knows how to do a brain scan? Have you done a brain scan? Like, do you know, do you see the inner workings of someone's brain? Like, just like, you know, if I take this pen here and I drop it, like, it's the same with like the brain. Like, are you literally small enough to go inside the brain and see what chemical is shooting where? Or are you a professional who can see it on a, because you have a microscope, whatever. I don't know all the terminology, but to be so committed to it, that's where I see the problem and the issue. Cause it's like, yeah, trauma can alter your brain, and it does. Trust me, I know personally. And we know that alcohol, well, I know that alcohol use disorder is a neurochemical disorder that causes your brain to push way more endorphins. So it's like, but here's the connector. Does trauma cause your brain to just push more endorphins? I haven't seen any research that links those two things. What does the trauma actually alter? Well, I can't speak on the neurochemical side of, like, I'm not Bessel van der Kolk. The body keeps
me
the score.
Me either. So we can stop with all of that. I just thought it was interesting. And what really matters the most here is what we're looking for a cause, because we're looking for a solution. But then you're just looking for the solution. And that's what people really need, is the solution.
Yeah.
And it's like, don't give up. So if I can pause here for our listeners, whatever you're dealing with, don't give up. You need a solution. Don't give up until you find your solution. If 20 of them don't work, then go for 21.
Yeah. And I just gave you the solution in large part. I mean, obviously there's more to it than that. But hey, if you find a provider that's willing to do this with you and support you, that's awesome. The thing is that they're probably not going to, just in my experience and, you know, everyone I work with, and that's why I do what I do. But I think that's the connector. Trauma can alter your brain, but how does it alter your brain? Because that's what alcohol use disorder, you know, does. And if alcohol use disorder doesn't cause more endorphins to be pushed, then we can't really actually, like, logically, right? If we're looking at it from a logical standpoint, we can't say that. And so that's the case with that. Now, I will disclaim again, outliers, there are people who drink because they've had a crummy day or whatever. But my whole point is that this is the person who drank because they had a crummy day, but they can put it down, no problem. That's the difference. When somebody like then gets obsessive thoughts and cravings and they start like spiraling and they literally can't stop, then it's not because they're drinking because they had stress or a crummy day. They're drinking because something's going on neurochemically. So that's that. And then the good thing, talking about trauma, is that once somebody takes care of the neurochemical, the physical side of alcohol use disorder, then they're free to actually work through their trauma. And that's part of my story. Like, once I was able to do that, my mental health healing skyrocketed. It skyrocketed. I literally did, in a couple months, the alcohol issues, what I could not do in nearly a decade. And then following that, I am just completely healed and better. Why? Because I'm not re-traumatizing myself every time I drink alcohol, right? I'm not putting myself in sketchy situations, acting out of a place of the trauma and the residue of the trauma, because that's what alcohol does. It takes like your rational mind away and your logical, you know, decision-making, processing, you know, whatever, right? Your inhibitions, it takes away. And so you put yourself in more sketchy situations because you're acting from that wounded place of the trauma, because it that happened to you, it all comes out. And so you're able to make more wiser decisions. And then, of course, what it does to you on a neurochemical level of just, it just messes with your hormones and just how you feel. And then, you know, and then you eat food that is not the best for you. And maybe you don't exercise, and maybe you get back into smoking cigarettes, which is what I would do. And so you're not doing all that. And so you can live like a healthier lifestyle and really just focus on you. And so the system who told me I needed to heal from trauma and then my alcohol stuff would get better, they were backwards, completely backwards. I needed to heal the alcohol, physical addiction. Then my mental health healing got better. So it's kind of my whole message.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that. This is enlightening. I think it's very enlightening. And thank you for your courage and your boldness of sharing your story, which is so different than many others, which is why you need so much courage to do that. When we go out and we're going against the grain, it takes a lot of courage and strength. So thank you for that. Before we end this, is there anything you want to make sure the listeners know, anything that maybe you forgot to say or something's coming up in you? You want to, before we go, I want to make sure I say.
No, I mean, this subject, you can talk on and on about it all day, or at least I can, because I'm passionate, but you know, basically just find somebody like who will help you, who will walk you through. I mean, you could book a call with me to see if we're in alignment, if I can help you. And if not, no worries. I'll always give you a resource to, you know, send you on your way. But I do have, you know, like a free PDF download, that really just tells you like the different medications that you could use. So yeah, but like you said, like, don't give up, like find someone who's going to help you. Because literally, oh my God, it is so easy to recover from alcohol issues. It really is. It's just, you need the right strategy and someone on your side. So
hope, man, that is a big thing of hope. We're going to close this out with hope. How can people connect with you? Are you on those different socials? What's your website? I'll put things in the show notes, but just so people can hear how to connect with you.
Yeah. So my website is, well, the free PDF download, the gift is crystalfidelli.com/3 ways to reclaim your power over alcohol. And yeah, crystalfidelli.com. There's buttons all over to either download the PDF or to book a quick connection call. Let's connect and see if we're a good fit to work together. And then yeah, on all the socials, it's at Crystal Fidelli Ministries.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for being with me today, Crystal, and sharing your heart with my listeners.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you, listeners, for sticking with us and hearing this controversial subject. I'm so glad that I get to share it with you to give you other options, because I love you. So till next time, I love you.
Thank you so much for listening to the Victorious Souls Podcast. You matter, and you are loved. We'd love to connect with you further, so please visit us at danielleburnock.com and grab a copy of Danielle's free audiobook. And remember, only you can change your life. No one can do it for you.